Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I've come to admire greatly a man who has been studying about, writing on, and indeed participating in a variety of capacities in some of the most important fronts in that war. His name is Rahim Kassam. He has been practicing the craft of journalism a bit. He is an accomplished author. He has been a consultant to one of the most innovative and important political movements in his native Great Britain, that is to say, the United Kingdom Independence Party that was led by Nigel Farage that brought about Brexit, among other things. He has been an editor-in-chief of Breitbart's London Bureau, and these days he is a Shulman Ginsberg Writing Fellow at the Middle East Forum and a senior distinguished fellow of the Gatestone Institute. He's also always a welcome guest here, and we're privileged to have a full hour to catch up with him on topics of mutual interest to us and, I think, to you. Welcome back, Rahim Kassam. It's so good to have you with us.
Thanks again for having me, Frank.
Well, let's begin with Brexit, since there's a lot of ferment at the moment about it. David Davis, the minister in charge of negotiating the extrication of Great Britain from the European Union, has called it quits today, complaining that the prime minister was being unduly accommodating to the Europeans. You fought this battle long and hard. You understand the stakes perhaps better than anybody. Give us your sense of what's going on at the moment, Rahim, and where Britain goes from here.
Well, there's been, for those paying attention, we voted out on the 23rd of June 2016 in a vote that really nobody expected to go our way, not least us running the campaign, surprised by what we had achieved there. But over the last years since that moment, this government run by Theresa May, who actually campaigned to remain in the European Union, has put together sort of bad deals, non-deals, and really been very quite effectively bullied by Brussels and their chief negotiator, Michel Barnier. That culminated in a meeting at Chequers, the Prime Minister's summer residence, last Friday, where she put this list of things together of what she was going to go to Brussels and demand. Well, unfortunately, the list was not very compelling. It was not very strong. It was not evidenced very well in the sense that she could actually sit amongst EU negotiators and make demands for these things, because as anybody who's ever dealt with the EU knows, there is no compromise as far as they're concerned. And so it took a couple of days over the weekend for people like David Davis, the single most important person in government besides the Prime Minister, as far as Brexit is concerned, to digest this, look at it, and realise that actually it would be a complete betrayal to Brexit voters and actually Brexit supporters, which now number more than just the number of people who voted for it 2 years ago, if this deal were to be accepted. And so he handed in his resignation late last night, and he was followed by two of his other ministers, Steve Baker and Suella Fernandez. The question is, over the next 48 hours, how many other resignations will there be? Will Boris Johnson find the mettle to do the same thing? And will there be a no-confidence vote in the Prime Minister from within her own party? All of those things depend on a number of factors. But when President Trump arrives in the United Kingdom on Wednesday, and continues his visit Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Theresa May may not be Prime Minister anymore by then.
Wow. The parliamentary process is something that most Americans, I think, find difficult to understand. When you talk about a vote of no confidence, Rahim Kassam, you mean within the Conservative Party, not a vote in the parliament. How does that work mechanically? Do the members of parliament alone vote for a new prime minister, or is there some other electorate in the event that this series of resignations, assuming it continues, actually does precipitate that kind of crisis for Theresa May?
Well, the mechanics of the Conservative Party and effectively how people become the head of government in the United Kingdom when the Conservative Party is in power are absolutely fascinating. It's why we've had so many, you know, quote-unquote, unelected prime ministers. Theresa May having been one of those herself, effectively, there is 48. If there are 48 letters handed in to the government's chief whip and the chair of the 1922 committee, there's a committee that sits within the Conservative Party to represent the backbench members of the Conservative Party.
In Parliament, that is.
Absolutely. If 48 parliamentary members send those letters in to, it's now a chap called Graham Brady, chairman of the 1922 committee, then it automatically triggers a no confidence vote amongst the Conservative Parliamentary Party, amongst Theresa May's own members of Parliament. And if a simple majority vote, if she wins by one MP, she remains Prime Minister. If she loses by one MP, the Conservative Party is compelled to enter into a leadership election, at which, you know, anyone can technically stand if you've been a member in good standing of the Conservative Party. But it's usually a member of cabinet that will step up and say, right, I can do this. I'm going to take the mantle. And I suppose a lot of people now are hoping, Frank, that it's David Davis, the man who's just resigned, who will run for party leader.
And should he do so, Rahim Kassam, presumably that would reinvigorate the whole effort to have a, well, reasonably robust British position on removing itself from the European Union right at the critical moment. Is that possible? Could things move that swiftly? And is that the direction you think it would go in?
Oh, they can move very quickly indeed. Theresa May is actually addressing the 1922 committee this evening. But these things can go within 24 hours. I mean, she could wake up tomorrow morning having realized that she doesn't have the confidence of this Conservative Party backbench committee and say, right, I'm done here. Over to you guys. Now, if David Davis were to step up, well, I mean, that would change the entire prospect. We are mired in technicality with the EU. What our customs sort of agreements look like across borders, what the Irish border looks like, you know, all these sorts of small things. And actually, in the grander scheme of what people voted for, sovereignty, border control, and the ability to make our own trade deals, we shouldn't even be having these negotiations in the first place. The best we could do is leave the union entirely.
Rahim, we have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to drill down on a couple of the outstanding points on this Brexit business, but also what President Trump is going to be bringing to the United Kingdom when he arrives there in terms of his own trade program. We'll be talking with Rahim Kassam throughout this hour. Stay tuned for much more about what is going on in Europe and what it might mean for us, and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Rahim Kassam for this full hour, a very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio. Rahim Kassam, of course, has been the editor-in-chief of Breitbart News London. He is the Shulman Ginsburg Writing Fellow at the Middle East Forum and a senior distinguished fellow at the Gatestone Institute, the author of two terrific books, No-Go Zones, How Sharia Law is Coming to a Neighborhood Near You, and Enoch Was Right, Rivers of Blood, 50 Years On, about which we'll be speaking momentarily. First, though, there has been some breaking news while we were on break. Fill us in on what has happened as we are speaking.
Well, Frank, in the last segment, you asked me how quickly these things can change, and I guess the heavens answered. Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary, one of the most senior jobs in the British government, resigned as we were in the break, as we just finished discussing just how dangerous this situation is right now surrounding the resignations for the Prime Minister, Theresa May. I mentioned in the last segment that she may not be Prime Minister.
By the time we finish the show, who knows?
Absolutely. But I mean, certainly by the time that President Trump visits, which would be an extraordinary thing to have a foreign leader, not least the most important foreign leader in the world, touching down on your soil as your government is falling to bits. But it looks increasingly like that for Theresa May right now. So I wonder even if we will be able to see President Trump going to the United Kingdom later this week.
Yeah, he may get waved off.
There is no government. There can be no trip.
Or alternatively, perhaps his visit may be the forcing function to get this sorted rather quickly and have a new government of a different character, which brings me to the other question I wanted to ask you about all of this. There has been, for some time, talk notably from the UKIP team and Breitbart and others about the idea that instead of this very unhappy relationship with the European Union, Britain could forge rather quickly a deal on trade, among other things, presumably, with the United States, a bilateral agreement. Tell us, Rahim Kassam, your thoughts on the prospects for that and what it will take to actually affect that. First of all, presumably with a new government, but also vis-a-vis Brexit.
Well, and this was really one of the major sticking points around the Chequers meeting last Friday, where Theresa May tried to ram a poor deal down the throats of the Conservative Party, her government, and therefore the entire country. She came away saying, yes, we'll be able to do our own trade deals and so on and so forth. But there was no proof, no evidence in what she was presenting that actually the European Union would let us get away with that if we wanted to retain preferential access to their single market, to their customs union. There isn't another country in the customs union, another country in the world that has that kind of relationship with the EU. And that's not to say that we can't get one, but there was nothing to show that she had a compelling case to bring them to that negotiating point. A deal with the United States, of course, would be, you know, I suppose Hillary Clinton once used the phrase holy grail to discuss TTIP and the TPP trade deals. Well, actually, bilateral trade deals are the holy grail, as most right-headed thinking people know when it comes to international trade. And something like that with two countries which are, you know, divided by a common language and have existing regulatory standards that fit very well to one another, that have market standards that fit very well to one another, well, you could get a deal done like that within a period of about 3 to 6 months. There wouldn't be the sort of 13 rounds of negotiations as we've seen with the US-EU TTIP deal, and there certainly wouldn't need to be. I mean, the US got a bilateral trade deal, I think, with Oman sorted out in about 8 months. So you just think, I mean, it would be not just the holy grail in terms of trade deals and how fast it could get done, but it really would be two very important fingers up to the European Union, its customs union and single market. So actually, you don't have to have these big unwieldy trading blocks in order to be good trading partners. And I think once again, you know, Uncle Sam and Britannia should lead the way.
I certainly agree. And I hope that that will be forthcoming as the dust settles in the United Kingdom. Assuming the president does manage to still be welcome in the United Kingdom, there's a government in place to do the welcoming. There is a lot of opposition to his visit there. Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, a rather colorful character that you've followed closely over the years, I think a Sharia supremacist by any measure, has made it particularly clear that Donald Trump is not welcome as far as he's concerned in London. But talk a little bit about the dynamic as you see it there in Britain vis-a-vis Donald Trump and an agenda like the one you've just mentioned.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. You say that, you know, there is a lot of opposition. I suppose there is a lot of opposition in terms of just numbers. There will be maybe 100,000 plus people protesting all across different parts of London. There will be this huge inflatable Trump in a baby diaper that Sadiq Khan, as you say, our mayor, has decided is appropriate to fly above Parliament during President Trump's visit. But what the media hasn't told people is both the counter-narrative to this and how they've actually been complicit in setting up all this protest. Well, let's go to the second one first. They have literally, between the BBC, The Independent, The Guardian, and our other biggest news outlet in the country, have actually been running articles that say, you know, Trump in Britain, how can I join the protest? And giving people the times and the dates and the locations and all that sort of stuff. I mean, that's unprecedented as far as something like this is concerned. They didn't do it even to George W. Bush at the height of the Iraq war. It wasn't happening, which drew a million people out onto the street. So you can tell this is much more confected than something like that. It is much more media driven. They want these scenes. They want their helicopters in the sky, getting all these people and getting the big baby Trump balloon in Parliament Square. The media are complicit with the protesters on this for some time, and they would never do it for instance, you know, I organized the Free Tommy protests in the United Kingdom, but we would never get any level of coverage for that. So that's the second thing. But when it comes to the actual counter-protest, there are going to be tens of thousands of people out on the streets to welcome President Trump. There are pubs that have already been renamed the Trump Arms in honor of the visit. There are lots of things going on across London where Britons, and actually things going on all across the country, where ordinary Britons want our American friends and especially our fellow deplorables to know that our government and our media don't represent the interest outside of London. I mean, it's like taking New York City as a litmus test for the entire country. Well, most people recognize that's not true. The same idea applies to London. So yes, there'll be hundreds of thousands of people and, you know, the media will whack it all over the front pages, but it's simply not true. President Trump right now enjoys some of the best approval ratings of any Western leader. You look at Merkel, Macron, May, Trudeau, look across the Western world, who's the highest amongst them all? It's actually President Trump.
Fantastically interesting. I guess it's somewhat similar to the situation in our own country, isn't it, Rahim, where the mayors of New York and Los Angeles do not speak for the red states that voted for Donald Trump to be president of the United States, or for that matter, people within their own cities that are sensible on the matter. It's easy to get distracted, and I'm sure there will be much hay made of this this balloon over Parliament Square, as you say, that will get endless amounts of attention. Speaking of attention and your own efforts and those that are more representative, I think, of what a lot of Brits, certainly a lot of Americans, are feeling, has been the evidence that Tommy Robinson was bringing to light about the rising tide and serious implications of Sharia supremacism in Western countries, notably, of course, in Britain. You've been reporting from there. You've been reporting, in fact, in your book, No-Go Zones, How Sharia Law is Coming to a Neighborhood Near You, about this phenomenon in America as well as elsewhere in the West. Talk a little bit about this phenomenon, if you would, and how Tommy has sort of captured the imagination of an awful lot of people who share his concerns about it.
Yeah, well, what's really interesting is I, like many other people, Frank, had this idea planted in my head by our media that 10 years ago, Tommy Robinson was just a street thug from Britain, that he was a racist, a xenophobe, a bigot, whatever you want to pull from these articles that they've written about him for well over a decade now. I mean, this is just an ordinary working class chap who saw things going on in his community in Luton, just north of London, that he found to be particularly distasteful. Now, did he always go about raising the concerns in the correct manner? No. But his focus was always things like rape gangs, grooming gangs, female genital mutilation, as you say, Sharia supremacism going on. The fact that in cities like Birmingham in the United Kingdom now, actually white Britons are becoming a minority. And I don't mean that in a hyperbolic sense. I mean it in a very, very literal.
Endangered species at that.
Absolutely. And there are neighborhoods, there are entire neighborhoods in the United Kingdom now. Frank, someone like you and someone like Tommy, people who don't look either black or Muslim will not be welcome and will be, you know, either set upon, mugged, beaten, and, you know, heaven forbid, for the young girls, worse. And so Tommy would talk about all this stuff, but perhaps not in the most, polite tone or calm cadence.
Now hold that thought, because there has been such demonization of this man, and I want to quickly discuss with you what has befallen him now for his courageous efforts to stand athwart this Sharia supremacist business. But we'll be doing that momentarily with Rahim Kassam, the author of No Go Zones, How Sharia Law is Coming to a Neighborhood Near You, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined for a full hour of very interesting, very important, very timely conversation with Rahim Kassam, an author, a journalist, an activist, a political force of nature in his own right, speaking to us today about developments in his native United Kingdom, but also more broadly, what's happening in the West. And we've been talking a little bit about this other a courageous figure in Britain, Tommy Robinson, a man who has for decades been vilified by many in the press and in the public square for having stood up for fundamentally Britain and its mores, its values, its laws, its traditions. This came to a head recently and has resulted in an absolutely obscene miscarriage of justice. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, and where things are likely to go for Tommy, as you see it, Rahim Kassam.
So as, thank you, Frank, as has been done in the past, in May, Tommy was standing outside a courtroom in the United Kingdom, Leeds Crown Court. He was Facebook live streaming from outside the court, and as he approached, he checked with the police officer standing outside the court, and he checked with the court officer who was standing outside the court, was he allowed to do this? And both of them replied in the affirmative, yes, that's fine. There was a grooming gang trial happening at that court that day, and Tommy caught some of the chaps walking in to the trial and was asking, like most reporters do, and he regards himself as a citizen journalist nowadays, asking questions of them, expecting no response, but asking questions of them. Well, actually, they started to shout abuse back at him on that live stream. And about an hour later, Tommy was arrested outside that court under the auspices of breach of the peace, but not charged with that, but actually made to stand in contempt of court, which carried a 13-month prison sentence. The first time I believe that somebody doing reporting work has been imprisoned under contempt of court laws in the United Kingdom in 60 years. This sort of just is going to show how much the political establishment, the judicial establishment, and indeed the media that mocked him as a result, how the lengths that they're going to try and shut him up about these sorts of cases, these grooming gang cases.
Unfortunately, Rahim, this is not an isolated incident now. We're witnessing increasingly individuals who are speaking out about this threat posed to Western civilization by those who seek to impose a totalitarian code you're very familiar with, coming out of the Muslim community yourself, as you have, Sharia. They're being, fined. They're being, in some cases, incarcerated. They're certainly having their lives turned upside down with all sorts of threats of various kinds from the government, the judicial branch or the executive branch or both. To the extent that this is now resulted in Tommy Robinson being once again confined for 13 months, is it the case that he's once again in solitary confinement, Rahim? Do we know? Because there's a threat to his life from jihadists in jail.
Well, you know, I speak with his family every day about this at the moment, Frank, because we are organizing the global protest against his treatment. And it's very interesting. When he was first sentenced, they put him in a prison in Hull, in the northeast of England, which had a sort of average Muslim population, prison population in there. I think it was about 5% of the prison population was Muslim in that prison. About a week later, without any explanation, he was moved from Hull to a prison called HMP Olley in the Midlands, which has a Muslim prisoner population of about 30%. This was, as far as we were concerned, and I literally speak for him and his family, having been appointed one of their spokesmen, as far as we are concerned, this was an intentional move to have him put in physical danger as a result of his imprisonment. And it's because we have precedent in this area that we know that this is the case. He has been set upon in prison years ago by Muslim prisoners. They know full well what moving him into a prison like that would mean. And so, of course, their response to it was not to move him back out of that prison to another safer one, but actually to put him in solitary confinement because of the threats against him. So punishing him for the threats made against him. He was released from solitary about a week ago. He's now back on general population, but he's in his own self-contained cell, and he's only allowed to leave it for 30 minutes a day for exercise. The other 23 and a half hours a day, he's forced to remain in that cell, again, as they say, for his own safety. So this is the way the British state works nowadays.
It's really obscene. Rahim, just a word about his previous stint in jail, also involving solitary confinement. As I understand it, he put the time to good use in terms of his studying on the, well, I think of it as the enemy threat doctrine. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yes, well, I mean, you know, it's not been his first infraction, and as anybody who knows him will attest to, he has never professed to be a saint. But what he has professed to do, and what he's shown that he's done previous in the last couple of years especially, he's shown himself to be willing to take the steps necessary to argue the case against Islam and Sharia on the establishment's terms. And that is, in other words, through, you know, good old-fashioned book learning, Frank. And making the academic case against this, not just the sort of protests in the street case. And he's been doing that. He spent his last time in prison putting a book together called Muhammad's Quran, where he actually took the Quran and he put it in chronological order and showed that it was the violent verses that are always abrogating the religion of peace, peaceful verses.
Yeah, replacing them, in other words.
Absolutely, absolutely, superseding them. And therefore, that in Islamic theology, as you well know, that this is how the Quran is supposed to be interpreted. So he put it together to show people, members of the public, that this was the actual Quran. This was Muhammad's Quran. And of course, it became a whopping, great big bestseller. And I'm sure that he sold a lot more copies since news about his imprisonment has traveled.
One would certainly hope. The downside is that a man who has spoken thoughtfully and knowledgeably, certainly of late, about these issues is being silenced, as are others elsewhere, as we discussed. One of the upshots of that, Rahim, seems to be an increasing popular demand for political representation, people who share the concerns about immigration or about Sharia supremacism or about the extent to which their governments are accommodating both to the great detriment of their societies, their public safety, and their national security. You have been very intimately involved, not only with UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, but also on the continent with a number of the parties that have begun to give expression to this sentiment. They're sometimes called populists or nationalist parties. Sometimes they're called neo-Nazis or extreme right-wing, you know, fringe parties. Give us, just if you could, at the 30,000-foot level, Rahim, a sense of these parties and what they're tapping into and their likely prospects as you see them, if you could generalize.
Absolutely. Well, as you said, this is going on all across Europe, Frank, and it's. I take some joy in saying that it started a lot in the United Kingdom first with the UK Independence Party some 25 years ago. Really, is a protest against how left wing the so-called Conservative Party had become, but really tapping into and representing the fact that people's neighborhoods were changing due to mass migration, that people's lives were changing due to mass Islamic immigration, that actually nations of borders and freedom are far more interesting and are far more of import to people than what's been offered so far, which is European Union membership, which negates your sovereignty, and mass Islamic immigration, which is, created, I think, over 200 terror attacks in Europe just last year alone. Well, now that's being replicated across Europe. The alternative for Deutschland Party in Germany, which is now polling equally second. I mean, by the way, Frank, 3 years ago, I was telling people that AfD were going to be one of the top parties in Germany. I was laughed out of rooms for saying it. The same thing with the Sweden Democrats in Sweden. Was 5 years ago a 3% party, is now a 25% party, leading in polls as the Swedes go to the ballot box in September of this year. And the same in France, and the same in Hungary, and the same in Austria.
Netherlands.
Exactly, who's been doing this for decades. And the big part of all of this now, Frank, is not that these parties exist and that they're taking power in their own countries, but the thing that terrifies the political establishment, or the legacy political establishment, is actually we're all starting to talk to one another, and we're all starting to plan together, and we're all starting to meet together. And that creates a bulwark against, I suppose, the open societies that have been foisted on us for so long.
George Soros's open society, I suspect, is what you're referring to there, as well as what the European Union and the establishment throughout the European zone has begun to see as deeply threatened by these parties and are fighting back, it seems fair to say. We have to pause for one last break. Rahim Kassam, if you'll bear with us, we will return and talk about a man who anticipated much of what you're talking about happening before our eyes at the moment 50 years ago. You've written a book about him, Enoch Powell. That and much more with Rahim Kassam of the Gatestone Institute and the Middle East Forum right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the final installment of this extraordinarily interesting and exceedingly topical conversation with Rahim Kassam, one of the bright thinkers and practitioners of national policy these days, currently from perches at the splendid Gatestone Institute, where he is a senior distinguished fellow, and at the Middle East Forum, where he is a Shulman Ginsberg Fellow. So you've written a book, a provocative book, to be sure, as was your book about no-go zones. But I want you to share with us, Rahim Kassam, the important insights that you think we should all take away from the speech that a British politician by the name of Enoch Powell made 50 years ago in April. Your book is entitled, Enoch Was Right, Rivers of Blood. 50 years on. What was he right about, and what were the costs to him for saying it back then?
I'd rather discuss what Enoch was wrong about, because it would take a much shorter amount of time. I mean, Enoch was right about almost every single thing. 50 years ago, he stood in a small hall in the Midlands in Birmingham, the city we just talked about, Frank, which is now becoming a minority city for native Britons. He stood in front of about 65 people, and he gave one of the most incendiary speeches about mass migration that I think the Western world has ever heard. I think you probably haven't heard something so controversial until President Trump came down the escalator and said they're not sending their best. This was known to Enoch because he was a member of Parliament, a Conservative member of Parliament for a Midlands constituency. So he saw his own constituency neighbourhood changing around him, and decided on behalf of his constituents to stand up and say something about it. Well, he experienced the day after the speech the ultimate in humiliation in terms of British politics. He was unceremoniously sacked from his shadow cabinet position, as the Conservative Party were in opposition at the time, by his party leader, Ted Heath. And the Times newspaper, really the paper of record in the United Kingdom, called the speech evil. In fact, that editorial written by a chap called William Rees-Mogg, who is the father of Jacob Rees-Mogg, who is now one of the leading Brexiteers in Parliament. And so you see how it all links together. Everything regarding immigration and Brexit and all of these things are inextricably linked, and even the figures, the characters, are inextricably linked over the course of sort of two generations. So that's why I chose to write the book. And what Enoch said specifically about immigration really rung true to me as somebody of immigrant stock. I was born to Tanzanian Indian immigrant parents in West London, and I know just how difficult it can be to integrate, especially when your parents have come from somewhere else and haven't grown up with a particular culture. And that was Enoch's whole point. He said, look, if you're talking about a couple of thousand people emigrating into the United Kingdom every year, that's fine. We can integrate those people, we can take it. But when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people coming in every single year, as we have now, 600,000 people every year, he said, that is impossible. And you will be swallowed as a nation, as a culture, as a result. And so as far as I'm concerned, he was right.
One of the things that he was widely criticized for, and among other punishments, sacked, as you say, for uttering, was what was perceived to be quite racist speech about the black man having the whip hand and so on. I think you're absolutely right that much of what he said not only has been borne out by subsequent events, but was defensible as a matter of just plain common sense. You take in large numbers of people without your traditions, without your values, without your attachment to the laws of Britain, and it will transform the country. But what do you say to those who point to comments like that whip hand one about this being racist or racialist or in some other form beyond the pale?
Well, firstly, Powell himself would have been very, very okay with you suggesting that he was a racialist, not a racist. A racialist at the time, as we knew it, was somebody who, and as Powell knew it, the definition was somebody who understood that there were differences between races. Not that one was better than another, and not that one should be subordinate to another. There were simply differences, differences in cultures, differences in races, in identities, in creeds, in religions, all of that. And that's how he described the word racialist. And so firstly, it has to be said, he would stand by that probably even today. But the second part of it is that I actually still use the phrase whip hand. And the reason I still use the phrase whip hand is because actually we've handed the whip to identity groups. I mean, this is where the identity politics thing has come from. In fact, it started in America with your Race Relations Act. You know, we only adopted the Race Relations Act in Britain in the late 60s because America had already adopted one. And so we followed suit, trying to be, you know, sort of open and progressive and tolerant society. Well, in doing so, in creating, in allowing the identity politics to foster, you do hand the whip over to minority influenced groups. If there was no whip, there was no whip hand, Frank. My assertion in the book is that you wouldn't need these sort of rights organizations and these diversity officers and sort of all these alphabet agencies of people whose job it is to maintain some level of power, some level of, oh, only we can say this, or only we can do this, or only we may comment on this because of the taboo around it. Look at the Labour Party today in the United Kingdom, charging white people £10 higher than they charge black people to come to their event. For me, that's a small part of the whip hand. You look at how Sharia courts and Sharia advocates in the United Kingdom are not treated and prosecuted in the same way as, say, a grooming gang that might be comprised of white people. That's the whip hand. And you see this all over the place time and time again. So I go into this whip hand thing in some detail in the book, Frank, because I believe that if we give the ground over, if we say no, this thing doesn't exist, and that this is a necessarily, sort of racist statement, then actually we ignore the entire problem of identity politics, and we hand over the terms of debate to the political left and the minorities it uses to affect its cultural Marxist end.
Yeah, including, among other things, silencing those of us who stand in their way. And, I just wanted to make one point on this business, because I think certainly if one follows the logic of what Enoch Powell was talking about, he was speaking about these cultural norms, values, religious practices and ideologies, if you will, that actually are not race-based, as I don't need to tell you. The people embracing Sharia supremacism these days hail from all over the world and all of the world's races. But it is a fundamental threat to the character of Western civilization in Britain, and for that matter, here as well as elsewhere. I was struck by the fact that the Labour Party has acknowledged that it deliberately engineer a new electorate by bringing in all of these chaps and other folks from the Commonwealth nations and elsewhere, for that matter.
Well, I mean, you're probably discussing specifically the comments of Andrew Nether, who was a senior advisor and speechwriter within the Labour Party under Tony Blair's government, and he remarked in an interview post serving in that government that the Labour Party had intentionally formulated this policy of mass migration, this policy of importing. Previously, Britain had, before 1997, about a gross migration rate of 120,000 people coming into the country a year. Well, they ramped that up to nearly 650,000, I think, at its near peak a couple of years ago. That was done to Labour, and what he described it as, he said, we're doing this to rub the right noses in diversity. Those were his exact comments.
Thank you so much for joining us. As always, it is a delight to visit with you, and I hope we'll have a chance to do so again in the near future, and that the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.